My name is Tuong Vũ, Professor of Political Science at the University of Oregon. I also direct the U.S.-Vietnam Research Center here, which we founded in 2018-2019 to promote education and research on contemporary Vietnam, on Vietnamese history and politics, and on the Republic of Vietnam and the Vietnamese-American community.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over. Thank you for coming on the podcast today. I'm delighted to think about the conference that you organized last month in the University of Oregon in Eugene, and thank you for having me there. At the event, I feel like the attendees were able to really debate openly and freely about subjects that traditionally get us all very heated as the diaspora. So thank you for that. And can you tell me a little bit about this event and how you began to organize something like that?
First, thank you for coming. I really enjoy your participation in the event, asking questions and also helping us to have fun, you know, on the last evening at my house. So really appreciate that you and your friend Mr. Trinh Hoi. So back to the event, we actually planned it for more than a year, and the occasion is the, you know, upcoming 58th anniversary of the end of the civil war in Vietnam and the birth of the Vietnamese American community. Right. So that's an important occasion for all of us to, take some time to reflect, right, on our path in the last half a century, right? Two generations of Vietnamese spanning, two continents across the ocean, to think about, how to go forward, given what we know about the community, how we have developed in the last 50 years, how we are doing right now, and the current tensions or problems that you hint at in your introduction, how to move forward, kind of imagine how we would look like, 50 years from now. The mark of 50 year is an important occasion for us to do that. And so that's why we plan like two or three activities or events. And it's not just, this conference, but there are other conferences that we have been thinking about, depending on the possibility of funding. But, like we came up with the idea and we discussed with the U.S. Institute of Peace based in Washington, D.C., and they supported it, and we in a part of it. And I had to figure out, because organizing a conference like this one is very expensive. It cost us about $65,000 to organize the conference. So I need to kind of, come up with the money first, the funding, to actually, get into planning. So we apply for the Global Peace Program at the University of Oregon, which provides funding for activities by faculty and students that support the mission of, peace and social justice. So we applied for it, and I got it, to pay for the bulk of the conference. That's when we can start, we could start organizing, planning, and so on. And it took maybe more than 6 months to kind of, invite people, and some people, rejected us, other people accepted, coming up with the full program. And oftentimes, just like my previous conferences, we had to talk to people several times, by email, by phone, going back and forth. People ask, what are you trying to do? What can I say? Are you really open to, frank discussion and so on? So I got a lot of, questions back from the community, from the academics too, about what we intend to do, whether they can contribute effectively or productively, and whether we can guarantee that, we can do what we promise. Like, I'm sure many people came to the conference still doubting whether you know they could be able to speak their minds, and I had to do a lot of legwork, groundwork to make that happen, to so that people actually show up and be open to the idea. And like at the conference, we have the I have the chance to persuade people, right? But then if before that, I just had to make a lot of promises and try to make people believe that it's possible to do that. And I had this experience before with the conference we organized in Berkeley 2016, in which I was able to convince about 18 former Republic of Vietnam top officials to come, and also the actors and the writer and the journalists who opposed the Republic of Vietnam government to come as well to speak. So I have done this before, and it was a lot more difficult back then than it's for the last one. So I kind of got some experience, and it helped. Yeah,
just to let the audience know, you organized basically a weekend of all of these academics at the highest institutions throughout the United States to come and have a discussion about where we are as the Vietnamese diaspora 50 years later. And there was a lot of different points of views in different directions. But we did manage to have a really lively discussion, but really keep it civil. There was no really nothing crazy. I think it could have been. There could have been a lot of craziness, but somehow everybody kept it very civil and walked out of there. I remember going to the last night's party. We were all in the room at your house, all these rooms, and we were all singing and getting along, and different people who had different perspectives were talking to each other. I somehow wish that it could happen on a grander scale, and was wondering to myself, how could you take this format into a bigger, maybe a stadium or arena is too ambitious and too big, but a bigger where you get hundreds of Vietnamese diaspora leaders to discuss the same things. I mean, that it was such a beautiful weekend, a beautiful format in the way you did it.
Yes, I think I benefit from the training in the academic environment, which fosters free exchange of ideas without restrictions and so on. So I do benefit from that training, that 20 years of teaching and research in the environment. And I think the university environment also kind of helped me to to maintain that atmosphere, right? I mean, instead of somewhere in the community, which would be more difficult to maintain, but I really benefit from the university environment.
Now, when I think about the cultures of people in Asia or the cultures of the Western communities, I think that, and I would really like your observation and opinion here. When I think about how hierarchical our society is with the way we address our elders and we address the kids inside of our families, and then I think about how loose and open the Western style of communication is, I start to think about the way the governments are set up in a very hierarchical ways in Asia versus the West. And the way that culture is set up or is in the West is it's a little bit more open. There's a lot of discussion at the dinner table in Western families. There's this free expression of saying whatever you really think about and how you feel about your day with your parents. In Asian cultures, for the most part, you go home, you have dinner, you don't speak much at the dinner table. And so I think about the way that governments are set up, almost similar to the way the inside of the family structures are set up. And so when I think about your work with talking about the Southern government of Vietnam before 1975, we were trying to transition into a democracy, if correct me if I'm wrong at all. We're trying to transition to this democracy, but it didn't quite work. Or if it did, there was this sort of hierarchical way. And I often think to myself when I talk to my family or people in the community, that perhaps we were never destined to have a democratic society. all over Asia. But can you correct that? Can you kind of help me to really go, wait a minute, that's not the right way to look at it. We were working towards a democracy. And I'm always wondering, how much does culture, our Vietnamese culture, get in the way of true ability to express within the family structure all the way up to the government structure?
Well, that's a great question, but it's also a difficult question, I'm sure you know, in part because, you know, culture is an evolving thing. And democracy is also, you know, as a system, it's also evolves. And as we observe in US, you know, democracy, right? There are moments of greatness and there are also moments of danger, of peril, right? So it's the same with the Vietnamese system, even though, you know, we started out, you know, from, you know, a colonial background. We had barely a decade to, you know, build a state and a government, right? So we didn't really have much time back then in the Republic of Vietnam. And so it was undergoing a kind of, you know, transformation, a great transformation. And we were not alone, right? Throughout Asia, you know, in Burma, in Indonesia, in Thailand, in South Korea, and, you know, you had, you know, military coups and, you know, government changes and dictatorships and so on throughout Asia, right? But now today, I just spent last summer in Korea, right, South Korea, and I live in a you know, democracy, right? So South Korea does have a democracy. Taiwan does have a democracy. Indonesia has a democracy, even though it's a little bit weaker, more chaotic than South Korea and, you know, and Taiwan, not to mention Japan, right? So like, Asian culture and societies do have the capacity to accommodate, you know, democratic aspirations and the functioning of democratic forces in Asian societies has been a reality. It's not like, you know, in a dream and or anything, but it's a reality in many countries in Asia, and people have adopted democracy and adapted to it over time. And it's also undergoing, you know, moments of greatness and dangers and so on, just like the US. So I do believe that, you know, in terms of government system, the Republic of Vietnam was undergoing significant changes with the, you know, a very vibrant civil society and free press, you know, in the late 1960s and early 1970s, as I have shown in our books, right? Our books on Republic of Vietnam do show that there was that, you know, vibrant civil society that rose up to defend civil liberties, and the free press that, you know, tried to do the same thing as well. Even though, you know, in the context of a savage war, you know, foreign invasion and foreign intervention and so on. So there was that political transformation. But in terms of the culture of the family, I think it also depends on the family too, you know, like maybe, you know, what you said about the culture in the family, you know, discussion, open discussion at the dinner table. Maybe true for most Vietnamese families, but I believe, you know, that there may be some differences, you know, among the families. And in the U.S. especially, you know, with the kind of environment here, the kind of society here, the kind of, you know, education that the children get here, the family, the Vietnamese American families have also been changing a lot too. And I guess, you know, like you are in your 40s now, and I'm in your early 50s, and I'm this, you know, in the same kind of generation. And then we were young enough when we came to America, or you were born in America, you know, so you kind of, you know, you are an American, right? And even me, you know, I came to the US when I was 25, I was young enough to really understand, you know, the benefits of, you know, open discussion, and the university training helped me in that regard too. So it's so I think it's changing, and there's hope for, you know, like 50 years from now. And at the conference, I was trying to, you know, kind of to help bridge the gaps between the two generations, you know, the first generations who, you know, grew up in Vietnam and the second generation who grew up here. The cultural differences, you know, there's certainly, you know, big gap between the two. And at the conference, we were trying to do that through, you know, bridging first, you know, like bringing a lot of young people into to the conversation together with the older people, you know, in an open environment. And the other thing is to bring academics together with community leaders, because the two often don't interact. And academics, you know, kind of, they tend to be younger, they tend to be more, you know, they certainly, you know, like to be successful in an academic environment, you have to be open to discussion, right? That's kind of a part of your job, right? Is to accept, you know, different viewpoints.
Right.
Yeah. So so that's what we have been trying to do. Yeah.
As a political scientist, how much hope do you have for Vietnam to transition into, I'm not saying a full democracy, but some semblance of a democracy?
I have a lot of hope, even though I see a lot of difficulties for that transition, because the hope comes from the younger generation, as Vietnam is now open to the world, right? So Vietnamese youth, they learn English, they can receive information in the internet, they see around their country, and they can see, you know, like where the future of Vietnam should be. And that's the most important thing. I mean, they're gonna fight for, and they have to fight, they must fight. If they want that kind of society for Vietnam, they have to fight, they must fight for that. And I have a lot of hope in them, as I, you know, I often have, students from Vietnam writing to me, or students from Vietnam came to be trained by me here. Like I've had two already, and then two more just came this year. So they came to be trained in a PhD program, and they want to understand political science and use political science tools to analyze Vietnamese politics. And I do feel that aspirations among the youth in Vietnam for change. But at the same time, you know, we have a communist government that's very experienced in, you know, ruling and have, you know, keeping control over the population and the society. So it's going to be a difficult road ahead, you know, for Vietnam to be transitioned to democracy.
Yeah. And as I travel down this journey of learning more about government and civil sort of lessons about the way we rule societies, sometimes I feel like there's not the lines are blurred, even in Western governments, in terms of control and the way we handle political dissent. It's not done and carried out the same ways, but the effects sometimes are the same in how we control the people. That's how I feel. So you can go to Vietnam and certainly not feel the government at all if you're just traveling through. And, you know, and sometimes in the United States, I feel like when you're studying sort of like the Black communities, there's this oppression that we can see clearly. So none of these systems are perfect. And I think they're all changing as we go along. That being said, I often wonder, and I have friends who ask me, what would Vietnam be like today if the Southern government won?
Historians are prohibited from, you know, making such counterfactual arguments. You know, like respected historians don't want to make that kind of counterfactual arguments. But, you know, like just for the sake of the conversation, you know, I think most people would agree, and even, you know, scholars who love or hate the Republic of Vietnam, most would agree that they would be like Thailand today, Indonesia today, perhaps, you know, South Korea even, depending on, you know, like how it worked out. But it's probably somewhere, you know, between Thailand and South Korea today. if it had won the war, even you know, if it just had not been invaded by North Vietnam, not been conquered by North Vietnam, if had been left alone, then it would be like Thailand or South Korea today.
You know, when I think about a culture like Koreans and Japanese, I think about a very strict culture that involves integrity. And I'm not saying that the Vietnamese culture doesn't have integrity. I think we're a very warm society. I think we're very nice, and we're very, but we also have this thing called kỳ cũng được, or we have this thing called yu yi, right? We sort of like live in this sort of warm space of like, you know, push comes to shove, we'll let it go, and we're not as strict in the way we, the precision of ruling, in terms of like the way the Japanese or the Koreans do their guidelines, we are not as strict. And so I think that can bring in a little bit of corruption, that brings in a little we kind of like straddle on this sort of like we it's a warm and fuzzy way of doing business. And I think at the upper levels of the government today and 50 years, 60 years ago, I think it kind of translates. So when you or anybody says we could have been like the South Koreans or the Japanese or the Taiwanese, and I know intimately the Taiwanese culture is they're very strict. Their moral compass is sort of Japanese, and I think Koreans are sort of like that too. We come from a warmer, you know, a little bit more. The word I'm looking for is we. There's a back and forth that we allow each other to have, and that sometimes I think inhibits true progress because of integrity. What's your opinion on that?
Well, there have been scholars who make the same argument about like you about the difference between Northeastern Asia like Japan and Korea versus Southeastern Asia like Vietnam, Vietnamese or Thai or Indonesian societies. And they make argument like, okay, so it's the tropics, right? I mean, in Southeast Asia, in South Vietnam, certainly less in North Vietnam, but in South Vietnam, in Thailand, Indonesia, the Philippines, it's a tropics, a tropical climate. Then people, go to take a nap at noontime, right? And so on. Like there are these practices, and also the climate allows kind of an easy environment in which you can easily find food, grow food, food, and so the pressure is not too much on you to kind of work really hard and so on. So there have been scholars who made that argument, and once I used that book for my class on the political economy of East Asia, a student charged me charged the book as being racist, like that kind of argument. But it's a common impression, and there may be some truth in it, in terms of the differences in the climate, creating different culture and people and so on. So that's why I would say that, the baseline for South Vietnamese society would be like Thailand or Indonesia. And if they had worked harder, if they had worked harder, if they had, if the civil society had struggled a lot more, and if the government had, worked harder, then, we also, came, many South Vietnamese came from the north, right? I mean, they also absorb Chinese culture to some extent. They could have made something like a Singaporean society or Taiwanese or Korean society, society. So that's kind of the highest they can reach. But if not, then they can just be like Thailand or Indonesia.
Yeah, like simple minds like me, laymen like me would make these ridiculous arguments about, you know, the temperature, the climate, because there's a culture of compromise within. I mean, if you think about Mexico, same thing, right? And you go north and the colder climates, you have to survive, you have to do things a certain way in order to get ahead. And we have this discussion on the podcast all the time. East Coast Vietnamese and West Coast Vietnamese, it's just two different ways of looking at life. I'm making really crude generalities, and I admit that, but I oftentimes run into East Coast Vietnamese who are just harder working. They just are more serious about the work that they do versus sometimes on the West Coast. And I think the West Coast is, Vietnamese are much more laid back, especially in Southern California. We're just much more laid back. We love money and we think about money. But the East Coast has a separate culture. The Vietnamese East Coast have a separate culture when it comes to the way they view intellectual pursuits.
Yeah, I mean, when we first came here to the U.S., I lived in Minnesota for 4 years, right? And that's when I kind of, went back to school and studied very hard and so on. I, keep thinking, if I had been to California, in Southern California, instead of Minnesota, what my future must have been different, right? And then after Minnesota, I went to live in New Jersey for a couple of years, and then Massachusetts for a year, and then California. So I do know, what you're talking about in terms of, the different cultures in the U.S. and how Vietnamese American also, kind of came to be affected by that. Shaped by the society that they live in, which is totally true, I totally agree with you about that. Yeah,
and as people who discuss these things, right? I studied anthropology at USC. That was my major, and so we are sort of like in this mode of coming up with ethnographies or putting together ethnographic works and interviewing and finding and discovering patterns. But like your student said, the arguments sometimes can be crossed over into the lines of racism. So how do we mitigate this idea of these general blocks of culture and society versus hard empirical science? I mean, we need to make some sort of distinctions about the East Coast Vietnamese, West Coast Vietnamese, or North and South Vietnamese. We need to make these generalities to make our theories work. But how do we, as regular people, when we have these ideas, not be accused of racism or how do we talk about these things intelligently without making these generalities seem simplistic?
Yeah. First, we have to be careful when we talk about big groups of people, right? To use the crude generalizations that you mentioned. But there's also, for people who accuse of other people of being racist, I think they need to be also be less accusatory. I mean, to be more forgiving. Like depending on the context and the attitude of the person who speaks something. We've had problems like that in college all the time, and I've been accused of being whatever sexist and racist by not speaking, not intervening when some student in my class was using the word retarded. Mm-hmm. I was teaching a course on violence and the state, right? And we used there was a week when we talked about Nazi Germany. And Nazi Germany, they had they put the retarded kids in a camp, right? And so that term came up when a student mentioned it, and I didn't intervene because I didn't catch it in time, or I didn't, it was a term in the book, right? So it was okay but then a student went to the Title IX office and complained. And my name has been listed there as together with the other sex offenders and so on. So I knew about that when a lawyer contacted the university for a list of complaints against sexist or sexual harassing people and so on. And my name was included in there too. It's tough today. Given the kind of climate. So I would ask people, on the one hand, be careful with what you speak. And on the other hand, for the other people who like to accuse people of being this or that, being more forgiving.
Yeah. And I felt that at the conference, that sort of vibe and that energy of being able to come in and just have these conversations and be friendly towards each other and loving and kind in our discussion. It was evident in the conference that we were at.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, that's what we try to make happen.
I want to ask you about this idea of the French coming in and spending all those years colonizing and having an effect on our people. I often think of it as there were good things and there were very bad things that were taking shape. But as a political scientist and somebody who studies the systems of governing and the kind of the buildup of the state, what do you think, what is your opinion about the French's imprint on our culture? As somebody who studies this, do you have a sentiment about if it was a good thing or a bad thing for the people of Vietnam? How do you feel that on a historical level? Because I always think about this question as I'm growing up. You know, there's so many beautiful things about it and there's so many bad things about it. But I always wanted to know from a political science, are we better off having the French come in?
Well, that's another very controversial topic that you put me in.
I'm
But
sorry, I just.
no. I mean, as scholars, we have to deal with these issues. My answer is that French colonization was essentially, and in political terms and cultural terms and social terms, it was forced modernization. It was modernization by force. So a force coming from outside took over the government, got rid of, the old government and a lot of, things associated with it, from the use of Chinese characters, right, in official communication to the other policies to keep, people in the villages and so on. So the French came in and kind of, liberated society in that sense. Like bringing kind of modern ideas about the state, about the nation, about government, about the economy, and so on, to Vietnamese society, who was kept ignorant by the rulers at the time. So we should not be nice to the kings and queens and royalty families that ruled Vietnam before the French came. Right, they were Vietnamese, but then they also, they were also keeping Vietnamese ignorant by not opening the country to modernization. Like as the rulers of Thailand did, right? Siam at the time, rulers of Siam did, and or Japan, right? So rulers of Japan and Siam did open their countries up and modernize their country, which make their country be, strong. But the rulers of Vietnam and other, most other, Asian societies failed to do that. And that was their mistake. And we should not be nice to them. Even when we talk about the French colonizing us and exploiting us and oppressing us, like would they have been better, under their own rulers? And if we think of, the people who took over from the French, especially the communist regime, they still don't allow, they still until today don't allow private press, right? Private media. Whereas, it was them who demanded the French to give the Vietnamese the freedom of speech, and the freedom of the press. But then they have not, after 70 years of ruling over the country, still deny the Vietnamese that right to have a free press. So we should be critical of the French, but we also should be critical of the Vietnamese rulers before them and after them as well.
That's such a fair and balanced perspective because I've been doing this for a few years and I haven't heard anybody really call out the rulers that were there before the French came in. And I think that's very fair because when I think about growing up Vietnamese Catholic, I get really upset and I'm very angry about, how can my mom and dad buy into a religion wholesale that was brought in by another country? that before we didn't have that existing. We had Buddhism. And how could you force this colonizing force onto your children and believe it wholesale, believe it wholeheartedly that this is the truth when it was brought into your country just, you know, 150 years ago? And so I live with this sentiment that, you know, we have this like imported way of believing in spirituality that is just not fair.
I totally understand that. But I think religion can be a liberating force for, you know, people in such, you know, poor and oppressed society as, you know, in Vietnam before the French came. And, you know, I also compare, you know, Vietnam and Korea at the time, you know, during the colonial period. And it's interesting that, you know, in Korea, Protestantism, right, Protestantism was considered liberating. And a lot of Korean, fighters for independence were Protestant. And in Vietnam, it's unfortunate association between Catholicism and the French, right? But in Korea, the Americans introduced Protestantism, and the Koreans used that against the Japanese who were not Protestant, right? So religion can be a liberating force, and the association with the French and Catholicism is unfortunate. But Catholicism, if we understand it, and if you understand your parents and your grandparents and so on more, then you may think of Catholicism as a liberating force for them at the time in that context, and so they came to believe it, and they spread the belief to you, still in that good spirit. Even though, you know, like from our perspective today, we may associate Catholicism with the French. But then there have been, you know, like new scholarship showing that that was not really true. That was just, you know, part of it. You know, there were some priests who were trying to push for French colonization, but there also were other priests, you know, other Catholic priests who were sincerely believing in helping Vietnamese society out of their situation at the time, helping to, you know, giving them the hope in the future, and, you know, offering them education, offering them opportunities. And I'm not Catholic, you know, I'm not saying good thing about Catholicism, because I'm a Buddhist, right? I'm not Catholic. So here's, you know, from the new scholarship talking about the positive role of Catholicism. And many Catholics play a very prominent role in the liberation movement, independence movement. And they were not acting as lackeys of the French at all.
This episode is brought to you by Songkhai Distillery, my only go-to gin company. Established in 2018, Songkhai Distillery is Vietnam's first gin distillery, founded by Daniel Nguyen, a Vietnamese American from Southern California. No matter how many people I have at my parties, we are always pouring Songkhai gin. Songkhai gin is handcrafted in small batches and prioritizes using botanicals and ingredients that are native and heirloom to Vietnam. The result is a product uniquely Vietnamese in taste and aroma. Songkhai is now growing to include rice wine and traditional Vietnamese herbal liqueurs similar to Amaro. Songkhai prides itself in Vietnam, from the farmers who grow the fruits and herbs to the artists behind the artwork and design. Songkhai is a community effort of people who are proud to be Vietnamese and collectively embody the spirit of Vietnam. Again, this is a perspective I have never thought of as well, because I've always felt like it was the lackeys of the French. But I think it's, you know, point taken. I really do. I can see that. And I want to go into this rabbit hole of the difference between, because this is second time this week that I've heard the idea of Protestantism going into countries that have really turned the economies of these countries. I heard a news program on NPR this week about the countries that the Protestant religion came into versus other religions that picked up on. And the idea of Protestantism versus Catholicism is there are subtle differences, I think, in the way that the Protestant religion is set up versus Catholicism. Would you be able to speak on that? Because I think I, you know, today is the first time I've heard of Protestantism coming into South Korea versus Catholicism. And I think the two societies and the way it's structured and has grown as a result of the two different Christian religions coming in, making a imprint on the work ethic, the way they view their morals and business. There's all of these implications. I don't know if you have enough information to talk about that.
Well, I understand what you're talking about, but I don't know a lot about these religions to talk about them in any deep way. I know Protestantism, the Protestant Church is less hierarchical, like more open, and it's perhaps it allows the believers a more active role in pursuing other worldly careers and businesses and so on. But like back in the 19th century and early 20th century, I don't think they were that different. I mean, in terms of their being introduced into these Eastern societies and playing a role of sometimes against the government, sometimes on the same side with the government. So it's a lot more about their interaction with the society and the government than about the individuals, I think.
Now, our generation, multi-generational existence in the diaspora here outside of Vietnam, especially here in the US, it's factions. There's a lot of factions, and it could be generational, it could be cultural, it could be East Coast, West Coast. It could be so many different things that create different perspectives in the diaspora. But one thing that is hard to look away from is the ideas of the flag. The yellow flag with the three stripes. The transition of the generations that are younger than myself. I was one of the first born in the right after the war, 75. I was born in November 75. And I noticed that the young kids in their 20s today, when they're on their iPhones and they are, proud to be Vietnamese, they put the red flag with the yellow star. This is such a weird time to be alive as a Vietnamese person, especially where I stand. I'm right in the middle of these two, sort of like my parents' generation, and then the kids are in their 20s. How do we process this going forward? Is it something that we need to focus on, or is it eventually, I hate to say this, but die off because that flag is going to eventually be a red flag and a yellow star. And, what's your perspective on sort of the sentiments that go along with these two flags?
I was, 10 years old when the Republic collapsed, right? So I was 10 years old. And I had ties to the former government through my father. So I understand their loyalty to that flag, their deep loyalty. And I understand that, things might have changed, throughout the post-war period. But, the more persecution they suffered from the communist regime, the more loyal they have become to that flag, right? It's not like I think their belief in the flag, just like, or their loyalty to the flag, just like any subject that we study as political scientists, they evolve, they continue to evolve. They're not something that's fixed, 100% fixed. So I've seen, I've lived through the post-war years in communist society. Right. And I came to US when I was 25. And I've seen at first, I don't think that the attachment was to the flag was that obvious in my first years here. Like that was in the early 1990s. But when the Vietnamese communist government actually was trying to push the US government to ban the flag, during their visit to the US, that's when the community started to organize and try to make that flag official, recognized as the official flag of the Vietnamese American community. So I saw that movement began or was triggered by the Vietnamese government effort in Vietnam trying to, you know, ban that flag. And I was at Berkeley at the time, and I had, you know, Vietnamese officials visiting the university, and I was sitting at lunch with them, and they were expressing their very strong disagreement, disapproval of the flag. You know, like, why did those Vietnamese here showing those flags? We just don't want to see them. They just the puppet flag, and so on. So they came here and they actually insulted us. That prompted many of us into action to protect that flag. So back to my argument about the evolution of loyalty. I think the loyalty may become stronger, may become weaker, but at this point, it has become in many places and to many people, especially the older generation, the symbol of our community. It has become at this point, it has become the symbol, and so it's important to recognize and accept and respect the symbol for the sake of the community, I think. Even though, you know, for younger generation, they may not have any loyalty to that flag, or they don't even understand, you know, like why that flag is here and so on. But it's important to respect that as the aspiration of the community, as a community symbol. And I hope the Vietnamese Communist government would, you know, be more open, would be would adopt true sincerity, sincere reconciliation with the community. Then at that point, the flag would not be that important anymore, you know. And also in case, you know, like the Vietnamese government may collapse and may not exist anymore, you know, the red flag may disappear too. So, you know, so you would not, so I would not be too worried, too concerned about that flag. I would, you know, take it as we go. And, you know, if I organize a community event, I will have the flag salutation ceremony. It's fine. But if I do it on campus, you know, it's not the environment and then I would tell people that, you know, like I respect the flag, and, you know, that, but that doesn't mean that I have to display it, you know, everywhere I go, I have to mention it, you know, in every sentence, you know, like, that's not right, right? So I just like I respect my ancestors, you know, I love my ancestors and respect them, but I don't mention them whenever I speak. So it's the same with the flag. I respect it and I welcome it, but you know, like depending on the kind of activities and environment, if we want an academic open discussion, then we would not do that, and it's fine. The community should accept that as well. That's which is why I'm trying to bring academics to the community so both can understand each other better.
You know, I think the hard part is the weaponizing of the idea that, well, it doesn't show up as much in young generations in the United States, but I think at the mid-tier, sort of in the 40s and 50s, you know, if there's political activity like the Little Saigon American politics level, they weaponize this idea of being a communist or anti-communist, and they weaponize it going both ways. And I think that's the kind of the hard pill to swallow at this point. Yeah. It's like, it's not rooted in reality, but it is definitely, this flag is weaponized in a certain way that makes it very uncomfortable for generations like mine to sit and allow that to happen, because I know the truth is could be far more sinister than this symbol of, you know, our parents' loyalty, which, you know, it has nothing to do with second generation like me or third generation lives that's used as a weapon sometimes. And I think that is something that needs to stop.
Yeah, I also, you know, kind of talk to the community whenever we talk to them to be open to, you know, different ideas and opinions and not to try to force, you know, the older generations' ideas and symbols on the young people. And I was able to tell them that, you know, it would be more effective actually if you just let them choose. And some of them may not choose, some of them, but you know, some of them may choose, you know, the flag as the symbol as well. So it's just, you know, we live in an open and free society. We should let that happen and not try to weaponize either way, like you say. Yeah.
Yes. And that's a funny point you bring up. We live in an open society, a free society. So why are we sometimes sanctioning our own words and censoring our own community from being able to speak, right? If we're living in a true and free society, we should be able to say whatever we want and pick whatever we want and do whatever we want. But, you know, of course, without it harming anybody, but we should be able to kind of express freely what our views are. And I think sometimes it's stymied. It's held back in the societies that we live in the diaspora.
Yeah, yeah. It's unfortunate that, you know, like many people carry a heavy baggage, you know, from the past. I think the younger generation should understand them more and be forgiving more. I think both sides need to be forgiving more. The older generation need to, you know, understand the youth more and, you know, forgive more for you know, whatever they think or do. And the younger generation should also forgive the older generation more for, you know, their own belief and so on. Yeah.
Now, when I think about the paths to development, societies developing, and we think, you know, I always bring up Korea, South Korea. What does Vietnam need to have in their toolbox for the next 50 years to get to the point where heavy development and infrastructure is happening in Vietnam, both on the government, entertainment, whatever you name? What needs to happen more, in your opinion?
Yeah, in a talk that I gave a few months ago to a Singaporean audience, I talked about Vietnam wanting to be South Korea, but it has not been able to, you know, perform like South Korea economically, mainly because of the, you know, the first thing is the bureaucracy. The bureaucracy today in Vietnam is recruited and promoted based on their political loyalties. And political loyalties oftentimes are reduced to family ties. You know, so if you are born of a, you know, communist official's family, then you just, you know, immediately assume to be loyal, right? So, and you would get, you know, promoted in the, get recruited and promoted in the bureaucracy without any, you know, without real ability to contribute anything. So that's a problem with Vietnam. And one thing that Vietnam should do that I advise them to do is to try to make the bureaucracy at least, you know, some, you know, a meritocracy, right? Based on merit, recruited and promoted based on merit and not based on political loyalty. You know, of course, you know, like the top level of bureaucracy, you know, you still need, you know, officials loyal to the regime, right? But then, you know, below the, you know, level of maybe deputy minister, you know, you need to have people with real ability, right, with talents and so on, education. So that's the first thing that Vietnam needs to do. The second thing is to get rid of the state-owned sector. So South Korea developed its economy, you know, it rely on the big corporations, right? So big spending corporations in many industries, and like, you know, like Samsung, like Hyundai, right? So Vietnam also tried to follow the same strategy, but relying on state-owned companies. That's the key difference. So the state-owned enterprises in Vietnam have been so corrupt and inefficient. That's why Vietnam has never, you know, developed its economy very fast like Korea. So that's the second problem. But the Vietnamese party, Communist Party, they need the state-owned sector to demonstrate their commitment to socialism. You know, socialism, you have to have state-owned sector. You need to have state-owned the state need to own public property, right? So that's why they want to keep the system, but that system is not helping Vietnam to develop to become a dragon or tiger. So that's the second thing. The bureaucracy is the first thing. The state-owned sector is the second thing. And then the next, the final thing is the political freedom to a certain extent. Because you know, in South Korea, even though even under the dictatorship of Park Chung-hee, there was some, you know, freedom of press. Yeah? There was opposition parties. There were, you know, academic freedom in university. So you were allowed to study anything except maybe communism and except criticizing the government. But in Vietnam, you're not allowed to study anything except Marxism-Leninism. So it's really a tight locked on the mind of people, keeping them ignorant. So Vietnam need to have a relative, you know, a good some degree of press freedom, some degree of academic freedom, some degree of freedom of expression and organization, then it can become a South Korea. Yeah.
The hope that I have for Vietnam, based on what you just answered, is a few things. I remember in the 90s going to college with a few of Con Cháu Cha, I guess that's what we call it, or Con Quốc Cán Bộ, or all of these government kids that were coming to the United States that were studying amongst us. And a few short years later, after getting their master's or PhD, they go right back to Vietnam and they started these venture capital firms. They became leaders in different sectors. So that's hope number one. Number two, universities like Fulbright University, who really stress and preach academic freedom, even if they don't really knock that out of the park, at least there's conversation behind academic freedom.
Right.
That's two things. And the third thing is obviously the internet and the freedom to browse sort of freely with YouTube videos. And, you know, they can control as much as they want, but I mean, it's still going to seep out this idea of governments needing to be more open-minded. And I think the youth of Vietnam eventually will see the openness of the West. So all of these things are kind of like in working in parallel with each other. And I think it, to some degree it's working, but why is it so heavily blocked with, in the last 20, 30 years, we know that there's an influx of all of these change agents, but why hasn't it flipped yet? What does it need to flip over? And I'm not saying a full democracy like the US, but a little bit more, you know, even like in movies, why can't we have lifted the censorship? Why can't they just see that we just need to be able to freely express what we need to make the society a better place? What's the hold? What do you think culturally is holding the people or the gatekeepers in control of entertainment, politics, everything? What is holding them back as a society from fully opening up?
It's the need to protect the power and the privileges of the regime and their officials. That's what's holding back in my analysis. And I've given talks in many places about this. The regime care mostly, and at the highest order, priority is its own security. And that's why it spent a lot, you know, on the police to survey the population, to keep control of society. And the situation has become worse in the last 12 years under Nguyễn Phú Trọng, the current party secretary. There are four police generals in the Politburo of 16 members. So 16 top leaders of Vietnam, four of them, you know, kind of developed their career in the police, in the Ministry of Public Security. And so they emphasize regime security over everything else. So they have refused to accept, even though they must allow, you know, a degree of intellectual freedom, information freedom, because of, you know, they need to open up Vietnam. They need to keep investment coming in. And they need to increase the amount of exports to make money and so on. But then at the same time, they also care about regime security, and they observe society very closely. And whenever they see you know, it's getting a bit out of hand, they will strike back and take back the control, like the decree on press freedom that they call it press reorganization that they just issued like 2 years ago, that shut down Zing News. You know, you may know Zing.
Yes.
News. So it's a quasi private media company, right? And has been shut down because the party would not accept a private press, and it let Zing News grow in the last few years because of, you know, the regulations were not tight enough, and so there was gap in the regulations that Zing News could take advantage of and grow as a quasi private media. But now that, you know, it realized the danger, it shut down Zing's News. So it's a game, you know, a cat and mouse game, kind of, you know, the society is always trying to burst out of control, push the envelope in their interaction with, you know, foreign countries, and they absorb the information, and the youth wanted to push the envelopes, but the regime is watching. And whenever they feel like, you know, it might endanger their security, they would crack down.
You know, this is so dark to hear, because I think about China and I think about Russia, I think about Vietnam, I think about all of these autocratic or these places that have these strict controls over the people. How hopeful are you with the world and the development of more openness throughout the world? Because it seems like with the advent of technology, things are kind of getting choked more rather than opening more.
Well, I had the benefit of living through the communist period, right? So 1975 was when it was the most powerful, right? I mean, the world communist movement, right? So it conquered South Vietnam, defeated the US, you know, Afghanistan and other places. But then it collapsed, right? 1989, like only 15 years later, who would have believed it, right? So very few political scientists actually predicted the event. And everybody thought that, oh, it's going to be there forever, right? But then it collapsed. So that's where my hope comes from. You know, like you see, you know, the rise of Putin, you see the rise of Xi Jinping, but you know that, you know, they are building their power on oppression, which is kind of against the trend, you know, of humanity, right? Of human society. So, which is why I still have a lot of hope in, you know, like their, you know, in the day when they no longer exist and they have to, they must collapse. To me.
That's very hopeful. But I mean, you know, we, not to get into strain to further, but you think of Netanyahu and you think today this is a modern, you know, we're living in modern society. And I don't know the audience where your politics are, but I mean, we could just see how Netanyahu is just doing what he wants to do in that part of the world. And I think that there's sort of a lot of Jewish people or Israelis that do not agree with what he's doing. Yeah. And there's protests everywhere, but Xi Jinping, Netanyahu, all of these Putin guys, they're still doing what they're able to do. And we're in the modern age.
Right. Mm.
How is this continuing?
Yeah, I mean, it's sad, right? To see these things happening, like the Russian invasion of Ukraine, right?
Yeah.
I mean, who would, you know, imagine someone doing that today, right? Or what Xi Jinping has been doing to Hong Kong, right? Or Netanyahu, you know, like his policy in Israel over the years. But I think, you know, like it's the good thing that I study, you know, political science, because I could understand these politicians, and I could understand not only what they are doing right now, but the longer trend. And that's what gave me hope. Like I said, you know, in the longer trend, they're gonna commit excesses, and they're gonna commit mistakes. Like, you know, Putin's invasion of the Ukraine was a huge mistake, and eventually they would fall by themselves. And it's not like, you know, like so whenever they do stupid things, like, you know, the invasion of Ukraine, the world's gonna unite against them, as we have seen. And it's the same with Netanyahu too. You know, he's pushing Israeli policy to the extreme.
Yeah.
And he's gonna have to pay the price for that. And hopefully, you know, like, not too much bloodshed before the conflict is resolved. But you know, anytime that some dictators or some, you know, misguided politicians are pushing to the extremes, they're going to have to pay, I think, eventually.
Yeah, it's hopeful to hear. What does it mean to be Vietnamese to you?
Never asked the question, right? Because I'm just a Vietnamese. So at the abstract level, and the more I grow old, the older I grew, the less chance I asked that question. I think I asked that question when I just arrived in the U.S. and I look around, and then very few people look like me, right? And I didn't speak the language very well at the time, and so I was forced to think of my Vietnamese-ness a lot more at the time, as I was trying to adapt. And I was able to at some point decide to move forward and not think about that question anymore. I think that's when I was able to move forward and be successful without worrying about myself anymore. And as I grew older, I stopped asking that question. As I feel like I'm becoming more Vietnamese over time as I grew older. Even though, you know, like I have, you know, lived in the US much longer now, you know, compared to when I first came. But somehow, you know, like, you get older, and that's kind of a dynamic that you did not expect. It's coming back, you know, like it seems to be something that I tried to bury in my heart when I came here. So I just told you that, you know, like, I made the decision to move forward, not asking that question. But actually what I did was to bury my emotions, right? Bury my own identity, bury my own culture to move forward. But at this point, they're starting to come back without my realization, you know, or without my intention, you know, like, they just kind of, you know, they have been hidden for so long, like 30 years in my heart. And now they kind of, you know, starting to come back slowly. And that's why I became interested and I devoted significant energy and time to the studying of the Republic of Vietnam that I kind of, you know, could not have done, you know, when I first came here, or when I studied political science and so on. But now I feel like I can do it. And that also helped me to release the hidden emotions that I buried for so many years, to let me be true to myself a bit more.
Can you share with me a few of these emotions that you buried? Can you describe it?
A lot of it was because I left Vietnam when I was 25, right? So I had a girlfriend, I was working, I had friends. So that was part of it, right? And then when I came to the US, I felt so lonely. I lost everything. Then I didn't understand the new society, and they didn't understand me either. You know, I tried to apply for menial jobs, and I was rejected. I did not get any jobs, and so on. So it was there was desperation, there was sadness, there was nostalgia, you know, about what I left behind, and so on. So many, you know, complex emotions that I had to confront in my first year here.
I think for me, being born here, I'm conflicted with that all the time because the memories that you have of being in your homeland for 25 years are tangible memories. They're real memories. They're this real perception of living in that world in reality for 25 years. And then leaving it, you had to kind of purge whatever you came with so you can adapt to a new life. But guys like me are living in this painful copy of a copy. I'm living, you know, a copy of my mother and father's memory is being copied to me and explained to me before I ever got to Vietnam for 2 decades, first 20 years of my life. And they were telling me what the culture's like and all the family members that would come over to our house. So I'm living for 20 years, my first 20 years as a copy of the copy. So in my podcast, I feel like I'm always trying to disentangle and try to figure out what things mean because they're just all over the place and there's no grasp of reality for me if I'm American or if I'm Vietnamese. And it's a problem, but a beautiful problem for me to have for the rest of my life because the questions will never end. And no matter how much perspective I get from everybody, it just never goes away. I never feel satisfied. It's like I'm always hungry. I've never been able to fully be satiated. My appetite is not fully recognized ever. And it's just a weird place to be all the time.
Yeah, so I understand, you know, the trauma or whatever the difficulties of your generation, and it's I respect that. I respect those emotions and feelings, and I think you, but based on what you said, you seem to have found the values in your position. You know, it's not like, okay, you were always having no clue, you know, about life or whatever, or the past or the present. You found value in that, which is great. I think that's the great thing, that you can make some sense or value out of your experience, even though it was, like you said, you know, a copy of a copy, but that was an experience in itself, experience being a copy, right? So whereas, you know, for me, it's you know, like I also, you like, benefited from my experience in unexpected way, like, you know, like I wrote the book on Vietnamese Communist Revolution, developing out of my real experience, like living then. But at the time, we suffer a lot, like 15 years, right? We try to survive, and I don't want to go back to, you know, the memory of that. But you know, it was like, you know, we had food for only a week, and we don't know, you know, how we would survive for another week, and we, you know, we were doing everything just to survive the family, a lot of hardship. So, but then that benefited me, allowing me to write that book, understanding the Vietnamese Revolution from within, and not, you know, as an observer, but I lived through that period. I listened to the propaganda day and night, and I understood it. I felt its strength and its weaknesses that I could talk about in my book, which really kind of, you know, is the strength of the book. So, you know, each of us, the point is, you know, have lived through different experiences in the community, and I hope, and it's good that we can find values in what we have been through, and make a contribution to the future generation. So now, you know, if you want, you can read the recent research, you know, and including my own research, to understand more about Vietnam. Not, you know, based on your parents' experience, which may be biased in certain ways, based on your teachers, what your teachers have taught you, which also biased in other ways. You know, you could read more research, recent research, which is more balanced and help you understand.
I know my reasons for reading these things, but what can you say to the audience? Why is this important that we reach back into the history and understand it more?
You know, that's true for every thing. History is very important to the present. Help you understand the present. But then for us, you know, for the Vietnamese American community, yeah. So our history has not been told, or has been told from the perspective of the Chinese, the Americans, the Russians, the French, and so on, and not by ourselves. And much of it is also told by the North Vietnamese, who are Vietnamese, but then, you know, they're communists and they were our enemy at some point. And they had an interest in, you know, kind of portraying us in certain ways, right? To enhance their legitimacy, right? So our history has been hidden, buried, or erased, or mistold. And so it's important for my generation, you know, with some good training and knowledge to really kind of bring back the history, the complex history. It's not like, you know, we were a paradise or whatever, but we did make some efforts at improving our lives. And those efforts must be recognized and valued, because they can give the next generation the pride in their community and their ancestors. So that's why it's important, because Vietnam was so much the politics surrounding the Vietnam War was so contentious, and that kind of distorted the history in a big way. And only now that, you know, like the younger generation of historians are trying to fix that problem.
Yeah, because when I think about the history of my grandfather and my father, served with the French, or for the French, and was killed by the Viet Minh. My father and his brother were both in the Phoenix program for the CIA. Mm. And so when I think about this history, I think about lackeys. Right. And I know you address this. And so when I dig deep into the history of my family, I feel like we serve the colonizer. We serve the white man that came in. And that is what I'm afflicted. Part of what I'm afflicted with all the time is this weird impartial history in my own family. And so when I see the yellow flag and, you know, and the red flag, these two flags, there's a big conflict for me. Like, what side of the what side are we on, the right side of history here? And my brother and I often talk about that. We're both members of the U.S. military, former Marines. We're third generation lackeys, if you will, right? And so when I think about this, there's a part of it is a little bit shameful. And to have somebody like you to come on to really say, well, read the book, read the history. There's a different history here that you might want to investigate, that we are not lackeys. We are, and so that's the sentiment I often feel.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. I hope more, you know, kind of your generation and younger generation read our history books, because we care about the truth. We're not trying to promote any version of truth. We care about the truth, and we try to show history in all its complexity, and also give a voice to our community, our people whose history has been totally distorted. So the like all these terms that you mentioned, you know, like lackeys and puppets, are the terms that our enemy used to describe us, right? And it took me a long time to get rid of those terms as well. It's like, you know, something, like I said, you know, I lived for 15 years under communist regime, and I had to accept their propaganda. And it just, you know, sank deeply into my mentality, my vocabulary, and everything. So it took me decades to kind of, you know, slowly get out of that. So I think it's important for your generation and the younger generation to also kind of read the new scholarship. And then if you have questions, you know, come to talk to us and, you know, like, and discuss them and judge the evidence on its own merits, and not relying on the terms that the enemies have used to describe us. That just don't get you very far once you keep using those terms. Yeah.
Thank you so much for your views and your openness to really talk about these very sensitive subjects. And I hope that you will organize another event in the near future, because I think it's an opportunity for growth. It's an opportunity for all sides and many sides to get together to have a dialogue with each other. And I really am thankful and grateful that you created something like that.
I'm grateful to all of you to have come and participated in the discussion, because I would not have been able to do it without the participants, right? So I need the participants in the room to really kind of, be open-minded and to talk to each other. That's the most important. And I'm very happy the way it turned out.
I really want to express my desire to do this episode in Vietnamese. So I hope to see you in a few days or a few weeks from now to have the same sort of discussion, but in Vietnamese.
Oh, I love to. I love to. Thank
Thank you
you.
very much.
Thank you for the offer.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.